All right, the next matter on calendar, Seminario versus, I'm not even going to try to pronounce that. Okay, well, it sounds easier than it looks. And this is docket number 64670. Mr. Mann, are you ready to go?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
David Mann. May it please the court. This case is important to thousands of Nevada parents who find themselves in family court without money, expertise, or a lawyer, and to the many family law attorneys who provide services to the financially challenged. We hope this case will provide guidance, especially as it relates to a motion to withdraw versus a notice of withdrawal in connection with the litigant who has an upcoming trial. Father believes that the family court should schedule motions to withdraw before the trial, as it's very confusing to what's in effect a de facto pro se litigant to show up to a trial and kind of have a lawyer and kind of not. Just to briefly remind the court of a couple dates.
Counsel, let's, as you're going through this and your characterization, we have a situation where we have a pro se. The pro se obtained unbundled legal services initially. Is that not correct?
It's correct that the service was unbundled.
And he was aware of a impending trial date, and counsel refused to go forward. My understanding is because he had not been paid for the upcoming trial date. And then on the eve of trial, so to speak, he then moves for additional time to get new counsel, to get counsel.
Yes. But it gets very confusing to someone that doesn't understand the process, and even the judge was confused when the judge said, why did the attorney do the motion to withdraw? In other words, if it's unbundled attorney, they should do a notice to withdraw.
Well, it sounds to me in reviewing this that there was a breakdown in communications and counsel, when she withdrew, actually gave the appellant here the name of three attorneys, recommended three additional attorneys.
Well, and we understand that respondent tries to make it seem like appellant didn't do enough to seek an attorney, but actually that's not the case. When the communication broke down, which is according to the attorney, and the evidentiary hearing was set, my client filed a motion to continue and sought the advice of another attorney. So the way it works in family court, as your honors know, is if you're an unbundled attorney, you do a notice of withdrawal. If you're an attorney of record, you do a motion to withdraw. What happened here, which was what was so confusing, that we had an unbundled attorney that did a motion to withdraw. So my client did the best that he could. He filed a motion himself to continue the trial. He spoke to another attorney. Matter of fact, it's in the record when everybody first walked in, Honorable Judge Ritchie said, why did you file a motion to withdraw? My client said on the record, I don't know if I have a lawyer or I don't. And what we would further argue...
Counsel, let's back up. That's nicely put. But either you paid your counsel or you didn't. You paid him for one. He didn't pay him for the other. He is aware that he was obligated to do so. There's questions within questions in terms of whether this was a tactic to delay or whether it was a serious breakdown of communication. But that's kind of off the board. The issue, we even hold parties in counsel when they wish to have a continuance. Timely notice of this, not waiting till the eve of an action to come in and move the proceedings back. So this is of concern. There's issues as to obtaining new counsel, allegedly whether he had or hadn't, whether he put any money down. So it puts us in a very precarious nature. And as to how we should deal with this situation, in all fairness, when parties are aware of time, and we impose requirements on counsel, and thus we impose requirements on pro se litigants as well. We just don't abate them.
Yes, Justice, but there, as you well know, procedural rules have substantive reasons behind them, and The mother's argument makes it sound as though he knew he did not have an attorney, but he did have an attorney because there was no notice of withdrawal, and there was also...
No, let's back up. It's unbundled. He retained him for a specific action, did he not?
Yes.
Had they, in fact, retained him to do the upcoming hearing or not? That seems to be the genesis of the problem before this court.
But when he...
Is there an answer to my question?
I'm not sure. That was quite a bit. I'm not sure. What was the question exactly?
The question is, had he retained him for the hearing?
No, he had not retained, and it was Ms. Ross, for the hearing. But when you even when you retain an unbundled attorney, which is basically all I've done for the last 9 years or so, you have to do a notice of withdrawal. Otherwise, the client doesn't know. So even if
isn't the representation on the record that I have been retained for this hearing only, so that you limit your ability as counsel coming forward, so the court doesn't say, counsel, you know, you've come into this as counsel of record, so therefore I expect to see you here unless I have a formal motion to withdraw because you've indicated. In this one, you've come in and unbundled, you make that representation to the court, do you not?
Yes, and then every single time you do a notice of withdrawal. That's part of the confusion here, so that's kind of helping me. If I go and I do a hearing, I do a notice of withdrawal. I may do 10 notice of withdrawals in one case because I do it, I withdraw. I do it, I withdraw over and over again. You would never, you should never, at least in my opinion, go to family court, go to a hearing, and then just leave it wide open and wait till the day of the trial to do a motion to withdraw. No one, including the judge, knew. What I would argue is he did have an attorney. She withdrew at the attorney or at the hearing. It makes a motion to withdraw kind of nonsensical if there's nothing to withdraw from. Why did the judge grant a motion to withdraw?
Let me ask you this. Counsel was present at the hearing, and the court was entertaining both the motion to withdraw and the motion to continue, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And at that particular time, your client actually indicated that he didn't want Ms. Ross to represent him, but wanted a continuance of the hearing. Is that correct or incorrect?
That's correct.
So what difference does it make whether there was a notice filed or the motion to withdraw? I mean, obviously there was a breakdown in communications. He stated very explicitly that he didn't want Ms. Ross to continue representing him.
It makes a huge difference because if he shows up at the trial and has a lawyer, a doctor in the hospital, if he's in the hospital, anywhere where there's a professional that says, I don't want to represent you, of course he doesn't want the person to represent him at that time. Had he known before, what I think escapes...
But again, he was given he had a period of time to retain counsel, and he knew counsel wasn't going to represent him.
But I'll try to be more articulate. What happens in family court, and it escapes the attention of many judges and fellow lawyers in the family law community, is the pro se, uneducated person that has no money does not see it like that. He thinks, and we have the evidence to support that, he thinks he has a lawyer. Whether she's fighting with him or they're not communicating well or whatever, he thinks he has a lawyer because she hasn't withdrawn yet, she hasn't went to court and done it. He thinks that she's somehow doing that. So it causes mass confusion. Even in the record, he says, I'm not sure if I have a lawyer. If a notice of withdrawal would have been done, which is a proper procedure, then it would have been cut and dried. And in his uneducated mind, meaning lack of legal expertise, he would have known and he would have been more adamant to get an attorney.
Okay. And just moving on to another subject, and again, the... the motion to continue was denied, and our standard of review is what? Don't we have to give the district court fairly substantial discretion in entertaining those motions and making their determinations?
Yes, of course, Your Honor. It's abuse of discretion. Yeah. And
that's a pretty tough standard.
Yes. When the court says, you want to get counsel, great, get counsel. The counsel's not going to exact a continuance. I don't care who it is, when my client had good cause that he needed to do depositions and discovery and such, when he was so confused that he didn't know if he had a lawyer, when it caused no prejudice to the other side because she couldn't even travel right then as she was pregnant, we think that that is an abuse of discretion. And then what's most incongruent is that the court then continued the trial itself for another reason, the other half. I think I may have neglected to ask for 5 minutes rebuttal. Is that, can I see that now?
Would you like to retain a little time?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Sure.
All right, you're
and
at 5 minutes.
And I see it's at 5:06 right now.
All right,
thank you.
Thank
you, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Winston, are you ready?
I'm ready, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Shan Winesett on behalf of Jessica Perschanowski, the respondent, and I think taking the lead from the court, the questions that were asked, the unrepresented parties is a issue that the family courts need to grapple with all the time. The unbundled services is a device to help those of limited means to obtain the representation that they might not otherwise afford, and also allow attorneys to piecemeal help them out and get out. But there is not necessarily a consistent understanding of all the family court departments about how it is that the unbundled attorney gets out of a case. And so in an abundance of caution, and it was stated on the record that Ms. Ross moved for withdrawal, and the court said, well, you could have done a notice of withdrawal. But she, in abundance of caution, filed a motion, which other cautious lawyers might do. In other cases, in unbundled cases, in departments, they are not allowed out until the order from that hearing is entered. So there's various different things going on. But the key is there was an agreement between the appellant and his attorney about what the arrangement was between the two. And he, at the time of that first hearing on the motion for relocation, that was the end of the services, as Justice Douglas points out. The services were at an end. He had an option to either find a new attorney or to retain counsel, that counsel, with a retainer, which he did not do.
Okay. Let me have you address a couple other issues that I'm sure opposing counsel will want to address on rebuttal, one of which is requiring consent. When you've got joint custody, physical and legal joint custody, is there a requirement that you get consent before relocating prior to the amendment of the statute?
Well, prior to this court's decision in Druckmann, I think that was an open-ended question. But prudent attorneys and prudent litigants in family court would always file a motion before the relocation. So whether that was a requirement at the time to get the consent under NRS 125C200, is that the
yes.
Unclear, but that was a matter of course is what everyone did in the joint and the primary arrangement.
In this case, you're alleging that while consent here was essentially she tried to get consent and basically it was refused.
Yes. She attempted to, and then she filed the motion. And I believe that the situation is the way I understand the statute.
Before you file a motion, you
yes, or you need if you can't get the written agreement of the other side, then you need to get the court's consent to relocate.
Right. Well, first, you have to have changed from joint custody to joint physical custody to primary physical custody for the person who wants to leave.
Yes, in the joint setting. In the joint setting, and
this was joint originally, right?
Well, that's the interesting thing, and the district court looked at it from both directions because looking at it from the actual timeshare that was admitted, that it was 2 overnights to the father and 5 overnights to the mother,
right.
Arguably on a weekly basis, that he only had 35% of the time, which means that she was a de facto physical custodian. So the district court said, arguably, she is the de facto physical custodian, even though the decree says shared physical custody. So I'm going to analyze it under both standards.
And they used Rivero to analyze that and then just looked at it under both standards.
That is exactly correct. And the court did point out what the family courts and family litigants are struggling with is is how, when you have that weekly share, how do you do it? Because the court has indicated don't count the hours, but do look to see if there's essentially 50% of the time. And so we've been struggling with that. And in this case, he just said, and I'll do it under both standards, which incidentally caused the court to comply with the court's Druckman decision, which came out after this decision, because the district court analyzed it under both standards, including all the Schwartz factors.
Well, how are you saying two standards? Explain to me about the two standards. You still have to satisfy Schwartz no matter what standard you use.
That's correct. But at the time this decision was made, we didn't have this court's opinion in Druckman that said you have to do it. So some of the district courts were just looking at best interests and the factors in assessing whether there should be a change of physical custody, maybe considering the relocation, maybe not, and then deciding the situation. But now this court has instructed all of the district courts that when you decide it, even in a joint setting, consider the Schwartz factors. But that wasn't the law at the time that the district court rendered its decision in this case.
What about the continuance? Why is it okay for him to deny the continuance when the guy loses his lawyer?
Well, because Your Honor, he didn't lose his lawyer. His lawyer was retained for a specific hearing. So at the time of that hearing, at that initial relocation, the hearing when the court set the evidentiary hearing, he didn't have a lawyer, according to his agreement. And he had an obligation to seek either to re-retain this one and the record is clear that he had to provide another retainer to Ms. Ross, who was representing him at the time, or if he didn't want to do that, he needed to find another lawyer. But he didn't do that. He didn't pay Ms. Ross the monies that she was requesting. And then at the eve of trial, he says, well, I've talked to another attorney, undisclosed in the record, that needed a continuance so he wouldn't represent me. Meanwhile, Ms. Ross had given him referrals to two family lawyers that would consider representing him at a reduced rate on short notice, and he did not avail himself of those references. So he's at fault for this situation, which when the court is assessing whether there's an abuse of discretion in denying a continuance, the party requesting the continuance needs to be at fault, according to this court's previous precedent, which was cited in our brief, the Giovanni case and the Benson versus Benson case.
Well, as long as we're talking about Schwartz, go through the Schwartz factors and tell me why Ritchie was correct in allowing relocation.
Okay, Your Honor, I can do that. So under Schwartz versus Schwartz, first you need to have a sensible, good faith reason for the relocation. Here, the mother was remarried, and her husband is airman in the U.S. Air Force, a master sergeant. He was transferred and stationed in Germany. And the reason for relocation, so she could move to be with him in Germany. And that is a good faith reason to move, according to this court's decision in Hayes versus Gallagher, where we had the same exact situation. In this case, the court permitted the move to Japan. And in that case, the court said, well, reasonable alternative visitation may not be available there, but it is available here, which I'll talk about in a moment. So first of all, the sensible good faith reason, and then whether reasonable alternative visitation is available. And even though the child has been relocated to Europe, the court provided 8 weeks in the summer and 4 weeks every winter, and then any time he could have visitation in Germany as well. And that is consistent even with cases of relocation across the country. And this court has, I don't know, 11 decisions where a comparable visitation, this court has determined to be a reasonable alternative visitation. So once you get to that point, there is a burden shifting that takes place in the true Schwartz primary physical custody situation. But even then, the court then goes on to the Schwartz factors, whether the move will improve the quality of life for the parent and the child. And in this situation, the court really honed in on the fact that the mother when she moves with the child to Germany, would be fully supported by the father and could be a stay-at-home mother to the child and provide that child with the care. And we also cited some sister state authority to this court regarding that concept, and I'll quote just briefly from that, is that the ability of a parent to provide full-time at-home care contribute to a conclusion that the relocation was in the best interest of the children, despite the fact that the parent opposing the relocation had been actively involved in the lives of the children. And that is a Weaver versus Kelling, a 53 Southwest 3rd, 610. That in that particular case, Your Honor, the concept is allowing a parent to be a stay-at-home mom is a significant enhancement for the child's best interest. And then there was also evidence provided about the environment, the on-base environment, the close-knit community there, the opportunity to experience for the child to be abroad, that type of thing. And the court stated that if you're pressed between having two separate households and having to be supported in two separate households, one by yourself here in Nevada and the other being with your new spouse in a comparable good environment, that the court said that would be in the child's best interest. And it certainly was in the best interest of the mother, which is something that is intertwined in the best interest in the child. Additionally, the court is also required to determine that the motives are honorable. In this case, the motives on both sides is honorable. I completely understand the father's desire not to allow the move. I wouldn't, being a father myself, I would never think that that was a dishonorable motive, but also for the mother to move and not be chained to Nevada and be with her new husband in Germany was also an honorable thing, which the court found it. Also the court needs to determine whether the parent will comply with the visitation ordered, and the court found that during the history of this case that the mother had complied. And that the court did not have a concern that there would not be a compliance issue. And finally, will the visitation schedule adequately foster and preserve the parental relationship? And in this case, there's ample time to foster that relationship in accordance with this court's rulings, and also the advent of Skype and FaceTime will also provide daily contact between the father and the child.
What's the length of his time that the new husband will be in Germany?
It's my understanding that the deployment is 3 years.
And if something changes, would Nevada lose jurisdiction over this child?
No. As long as the father remains a resident of the state of Nevada, Nevada will not lose jurisdiction. I mean, let's say this goes on for 15 years and the child's a teenager now, potentially Nevada can become an inconvenient forum. But in terms of the jurisdictional statutes, as long as one parent remains in Nevada, Nevada will retain jurisdiction. And I don't think that, certainly at this stage, that there would be any suggestion that Nevada would lose jurisdiction just because the child is abroad.
Should we be concerned with the conduct at the hearing because the father was precluded from calling the witnesses that he later proposed, even though one was allowed, and whether or not some testimony was put in as to past activity, TRO unrelated to this relationship, and some other were offered?
I don't think so, because, Your Honor, the case should have been prepared by the time of the evidentiary hearing. The issue of calling witnesses, marshaling evidence, producing documents and evidence, that's not an issue of whether we go to trial. It's an issue of whether we've prepared in advance of the trial. And I think the fact that he wasn't prepared to do that suggests that there was a lack of diligence on his part in proceeding to the trial. So I don't see that is a consideration of the continuance. Does the court have any further questions?
I don't.
Okay, thank you. I'll give my time back then. Thank you, Your Honor, and thank you for the opportunity to argue before you through the pro bono program. I appreciate it very much.
We appreciate your assistance.
Counsel, before you get into your presentation, you kind of stopped at a half a thought previously On the issue of continuance, you were indicating that she was going to be here for 3 or 4 additional weeks, and you almost started to say, and the court continued, but I didn't, you...
Yes. Thank you for that question. What happened was the dates of 10/21, the trial went through a part of the day, and then the court extended it, continued it to 10/29. So it actually happened in two parts. One of our arguments was that if it was able to be continued by the judge, then why couldn't it have been continued for the my client to gain a new attorney? In addition to that question, I just have 4 brief points. When opposing counsel, my friend said that there is confusion, I believe he acknowledged that the family courts do need clarification. And my question would simply be, does an unbundled attorney need to do a notice of withdrawal, or are they still in the case? Because as opposing counsel acknowledged that different departments in family court, where I clerked, they do it different ways. And attorneys and litigants need to know so that we don't have cases like this. Secondly, Justice said that I might need to answer this question as well, and it is our contention that someone would need to ask for consent in order to move per the statute. Most family law attorneys send an EDCR 511 letter and say, can we move or do we have to go to court? Part B of that, the other question was, should the court be concerned about the introduction of very old evidence? Yes, of course we believe so. She was allowed to introduce evidence that was over 10 years old about TPOs and such, but he was not. Thirdly, regarding the different standards, this is a part that the father felt strongly about. Her motion cited Potter and Truax. Potter basically holds that if a parent starts with joint physical custody and wishes to move, they have to get primary first. Truax says you're going to use the best interest standard, then you can jump to Schwartz and do the relocation factors. But that's not what happened here at all.
Well, from what I understand, the judge, in fact, the way counsel represented it was the way I understood it as well. He found that essentially the time split made a de facto primary physical custody, but he was going to evaluate it under both the joint custody and the primary, and so.
Well, after Rivero,
is that raised though? Was that issue raised about Rivero? Did they have a Rivero hearing?
I don't. They did not. They did not.
How could he use Rivero? I mean, well, in this case,
that's my point. Thank you. After Rivero 2 came out from your court, many cases went back to family court and said, well, on this time, sure, we want to categorize it this way. And it's our contention that's exactly what should have happened here. If she wanted to argue that, then she should have argued it. But instead, she
just basically... How does that prejudice you, though?
Oh, my goodness. It prejudices him a lot because he doesn't have the ability to go in and face it in two different sections and say, well, we want to argue custody, and then we want to argue relocation. It's just a big blur to him. And then compounding it with the fact that he doesn't have an attorney, it makes it even worse. Would there be any further questions?
Well, I asked this question yesterday in a similar case. If we would send it back, what makes you think it would be a different result? Even if he had...
Well, because...
You as the attorney and your associate there as an attorney.
Why
would there be a different result now after this time has passed and the adjustment to the living in Germany, which is a great opportunity, by the way, I think, you know, compared to this great school district here.
We think, Your Honor, that if the court would rigorously, we think that any attorney would go in and make sure that the law was rigorously applied, that it would be separated out, that it wouldn't just be basically where someone could file a motion and say, my spouse moved to Germany, I need to be able to go there. And in effect, that happened very quickly without the, no matter if they're in the military or not, or their spouse is in the military, they need to follow the law. They need to go through each and every point rigorously. And we hope that any attorney would do that.
Well, that's why I made the counsel for the respondent do that. I think he did a good job going through it to at least satisfy me that this wasn't any real mistake by Judge Ritchie. In other words, even if we sent it back, if those factors are all true about...
We could go through each factor, too, but I'll just one real quick. One of the Schwartz factors, the move would improve the quality of life. and even opposing counsel just said as one of his offers that the mother would be able to stay home. She already stayed home. There was no improvement there. And if we went through the whole...
Go ahead and finish your thoughts.
Thank you. If we went through the whole list, we would see each one was not met in father's opinion. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Counsel, we appreciate the arguments today. They were very good, and as were the briefs. And this matter will stand submitted.